Case number 17-7141, DC Healthcare Systems, Inc., Appellant versus District of Columbia et al. Mr. Marks for the appellant, Ms. Lipsack for the appellees.
Mr. Marks, let me just say for the record, Judge Griffith is not able to be here because the power was out in his house as a consequence of our lovely weather yesterday and today, but you can be assured he will be listening on the tapes and will participate in full.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Joe Marks. I represent DCHSI. The state court judge here told DCHSI to file a different lawsuit when DCHSI said that the district had intentionally underpaid chartered. The state court proceeding resolved the question different from the question that this lawsuit presents. The state court proceeding resolved the question what to do to protect sick people and a lot of doctors when an insurance company is starting to run out of money. That's what was before the state court judge. He resolved that question. But this lawsuit presents a different question. This lawsuit presents a question about why DCHSI ultimately lost all of its property. And this lawsuit presents the question, does the prevent DCHSI when the defendant DCHSI to lose all of its property without compensation and without sufficient process from the state? That's intended to do one specific thing, which is to prevent a party that loses in state court from taking a de facto appeal to a United States District Court. The is taking a de facto appeal is when the review reject the state court decision, and this DCHSI is doing neither of those things here. It's not because DCHSI does not that the state court decisions that were before it were in proceeding in state court, that here. Here, DCHSI says the state court resolved the question that was before, consistent with state law. It's just when state acts to overpay the party and then uses an state court process to take that party's property and take the party. Section 3 provides a separate federal remedy for that party.
You're waiting for a question? I have a question for you, which wasn't really addressed very much in either brief, but I just wonder, why doesn't Verizon, the Supreme Court's opinion in Verizon, resolve this case? This is a challenge to the decision of the insurance commissioner, right? The rehabilitator is the insurance commissioner, is that right?
It's a challenge to a decision by the insurance commissioner.
Well, just to turn my cards over. This is a helpful question to you, not one you need to resist. So don't try to think ahead. This is a challenge to a decision by an executive agency, and in Verizon, the Supreme Court says Rooker-Feldman doesn't apply to challenges to decisions of executive agencies.
Right.
Why is that not applicable here?
Or isn't it? Maybe I should give you a leading question. Isn't it applicable here?
Yes, I appreciate that. And I think the court could certainly resolve the question on that issue. I'll tell you, which is, the issue is with the district. The district states choice to underpay and then make up the difference so that DCHSI continues to have a company. Instead, it used this otherwise valid state court process. And that first and foremost committed by the amount of help that are involved with that. Right. So that's and it seems to us that that Section 83 provides regardless of whether the Verizon case is helping us here. But I think that that case is helpful too. If the court doesn't have any questions, I'm happy to sit down.
I was just going to ask it. It seems difficult in all of these Rooker-Feldman cases to disentangle preclusion.
Certainly.
And Rooker-Feldman. Yep. I mean, it does seem like there are going to be many preclusion hurdles given various things that your client agreed to in terms of empowering the rehabilitator. But you would just, I guess, urge us to separate those conceptually, and even where, as in, I guess it's the Exxon case, there may be dueling decisions, that would be sorted out through full faith and credit and not through Rooker-Feldman as such.
Precisely. That's exactly right. Now, we also think that the principles of preclusion apply either. I do think it is ultimately a subset of preclusion. What makes it different is that it's jurisdictional rather than...
I guess what's difficult is, so wrapped into the rehabilitation is this authority to make all those subsidiary mm-hmm. decisions, and its efficacy and finality is based on its nature as a kind of whole package.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say, oh, no, we're not challenging that, we're not appealing that, but we want to be able to appeal, you know, some subparts of it, I guess given the distinctive nature of rehabilitation, doesn't that maybe make it more of a candidate for Rooker-Feldman?
So, and here's why. The analogy to the Gray case from this circuit, which is a little more fleshed out, but which the circuit sort of endorsed in Gray. There are other, you know, cases like that also. This case involves something that a judge which was. In those cases, it's sort of ordered for the best interest of the child. Here, it's ordered essentially to protect, you know, the sick people and the doctors first and foremost, right? So, that's state law. State law. This nobody's asking to change the outcome. Rehabilitation. Charter is in rehabilitation. It will stay in rehabilitation. It's not going to change.
Does it exist, Charter?
It does. The business absolutely does not exist, but there's sort of a legal person that is chartered that remains in rehabilitation while, you know, creditors try to get paid. I mean,
And what's the status of it had these claims against the contracting officer? Charter did those claims been acted on? Or? Yeah.
Yes. So the Trump, which that disputed, if the state is to appeal the contract to Congress, they said, hey, you owe us tens of millions of dollars.
Right.
So those claims that Congress struck then the rehabilitator controls those claims,
right,
and the rehabilitator settles,
right,
those claims. Right. So if the state underpays a party and the statutory process where that party the original rules and gives the state health care at a big discount, such a has to provide some kind of remedy for that, to say, look, we've got sick people, Medicaid doesn't sort of fall apart, that would be a really bad social outcome, but it just can't be the case that the state can underpay somebody about tens of millions of dollars and then sort of destroy the
bank. Why not? I mean, when you think of, and I know this isn't bankruptcy, but when you think of bankruptcy, which is a little more familiar, it's taking a lot of valid claims and basically saying, we're going to do a workout here. We're gonna have a clean slate, and if you said, fine, for purposes of bankruptcy and reorganization and the health of a business going forward, fine, we're not questioning that. We just want to be able to litigate the underlying claims that you have purported to resolve in the bankruptcy. I'm not sure that, I mean, you say there's not a conflict. I see a conflict, at least functionally.
So, to think about this, but there's a real difference here. The premise of bankruptcy that the creditors get paid, and then maybe if there's money left over the equity holders, they get paid. That's pretty unusual, but you know, that's sort of what the bankruptcy is doing. The way that is really different from that. The way is not set to just maximize the value of the estate, and this is the state says this thing that I started with, which is DCHS stood up and said, look, the state is underpaid us by $60 million. We're short company to run, and we're not going to wait that they actually own the $60 million. I'm going to approve what the rehabilitator has suggested because the premise here is not the state and from have this special thing that the state permits so that people don't lose insurance, and in this case very needy people don't lose insurance, and so that they're away from the Medicaid network. You know, judge basically say, look, we're going to do it now. You can find different lawsuit if you think that the state has done something separate that's unfair, and that's what this lawsuit is.
So, the record is puzzling, and I realize this may be beyond the scope of what we need to really understand, but did DCHSI try to intervene in the rehabilitation proceeding before
2016? The short answer is yes. To intervene. So there's this conflict in August of 2013 when the rehabilitator has made a deal with the district to settle these claims. The rehabilitator comes to the judge. Anything that's there is pending. The rehabilitator just comes, gets thumbs up, thumbs down, reviews it for abuse of discretion, the order if you read that or what follows this colloquy, the judge just says, no, show it to me that suggests a gross abuse of discretion, and therefore I prove it's okay. So, the DCHSI said, you know, we had the report. That's right.
And you said, right. Too late, I'm not going to leave it.
We've got to move forward. You've had 6 months done.
Right. Just say too late. He said, you don't.
Right. So then it's just puzzling reading the cold record how many times your client, you know, thought, I'm going to appeal this. No, I'm not. So then there was an effort. There was an appeal filed in the D.C. Court of Appeals that was then withdrawn.
Right.
Any light on that? Again, I'm not saying it's necessarily what we have. It's just puzzling.
Yeah. So the first thing the appeal says is, hey, the judge was wrong to say that we weren't a party. Sort of the what's and what's doesn't make DCHSI more of a party, right? So, but why withdraw the appeal, right? But the rule is DCHSI destroyed. I mean, it's been doing things, serving 100,000 sick people, you know, sick and needy people in the district for, you know, a decade or more. It's about to be destroyed. They're trying. They've got immediately in front of them at each point. One of the things they did was they found appeal. Well, so the short says, well, if we win this appeal, what do we get? At least the judge then gives a thumbs down to the rehabilitator's proposals. That doesn't give us money, that we just sort of go back. We still can't sue for the fundamental wrong the judge, you know, already said. You know, the rehabilitation is the rehabilitation, and the Court of Appeals isn't going to change that. That's not even what we're asking. So somebody basically said, why are we doing this? And lawyers cost money. And they said, we're not going to pay some lawyers to do this stuff. And they filed. And DCHSI filed this lawsuit, which I think is the right lawsuit to file, is the right procedural avenue to say, look, the state just can't do this kind of stuff without me providing some kind of problem. Regardless of what Section 1983 provides, I think that the state court judge very much did not address those questions. The order said nothing about, you know, due process or take the takings clause or anything like that. And so for that reason, I think Rooker-Feldman doesn't apply.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
From the other side.
May it please the Court, Sonia Lipsack for the District Appellees. I'm also arguing today on behalf of Mercer LLC and AmeriHealth Caritas. Chief Judge Garland, let me start with your question about Verizon. This is not state agency action. The rehabilitator is, under the statute, appointed to essentially stand in the shoes of chartered under the aegis of the D.C. Superior Court.
I thought it's under the aegis of the insurance commissioner and then reviewed by the Superior Court. Is that wrong? It's appointed by the commissioner, correct?
The commissioner's, the rehabilitation statute provides.
You have to talk a little louder. I don't know why I'm not hearing so well. I'm sorry. It's my fault.
The rehabilitation code establishes that the commissioner shall be appointed the rehabilitator.
Right.
Of chartered.
Right.
And the Superior Court of the District of Columbia approves, for example, we have a rehabilitation order here, which was approved by the Superior Court. We then have the entire proceedings of the litigation in the rehabilitation court, where, again, very consistent with the statute, the rehabilitator was required to present his rehabilitation plan for reorganization of chartered. The Superior Court judge reviewed that plan. The plan had to be fair and equitable, et cetera. So the code is very clear that every step of the way through this proceeding, the rehabilitator was being supervised by the D.C. Superior Court. And the litigation record here is actually...
How is that different than the Maryland Commission being supervised by the Maryland Court of Appeals, which had the same degree of authority over its decisions? If the Maryland Commission acted arbitrarily and capriciously, I'm talking about Verizon, the Maryland Court of Appeals would have had to vacate the decision of the court, of the commission.
Well, I think the litigation here demonstrates that essentially the way this unfolded in the D.C. Superior Court was garden variety civil litigation. For example, the Rehabilitation Court would have considered and said it would have considered DCHSI's motion to intervene if it had made one. And in fact,
so would a commission have considered a motion to intervene? I don't see how that's different. There's motions to intervene in executive agencies and regulatory agencies and then in the courts of appeals. How's that different?
Well, I'm not sure, other than to say that here this was simply basically a proceeding that unfolded in the Superior Court where the rehabilitator stood in the shoes of Chartered and presented plans to the D.C. Superior Court judge, the Rehabilitation Court, who then approved every step of the way what the rehabilitator was doing.
Let's pass on that question and let's go to that second question, which is the nature of the approval. So the only ground that the Superior Court could reject the rehabilitator on is if the rehabilitator abused its discretion. In fact, if it manifestly abused the authority and discretion that was vested in the statute. That's the only role of the Superior Court. Is that right?
That's the role of the court under the statute, yes.
Yes. And that's the role that the court said that the court was applying. He said, my only role here is not to make a judgment I would myself, to decide whether the decision was arbitrary and capricious or an abuse of discretion, right?
That's right.
And that was the judgment of the Superior Court, that it was not arbitrary and capricious or an abuse of discretion, correct?
Correct. And the reorganization order in particular was fair and equitable.
Right. Now, none of those are the claims that are brought before us today. The claim here is not simply whether it's arbitrary and capricious. The claim here is whether there's a series of constitutional violations under a preponderance of the evidence standard, not an abuse of discretion standard. And the Supreme Court's made clear in its later cases, in Skinner and Lance, that if a federal plaintiff presents an independent claim, it is not, and that's what this is, independent of an arbitrary and capriciousness claim, it is not an impediment to the exercise of federal jurisdiction. The same or related question was earlier aired between the parties. That's what the court said in Skinner. It only applies when you're asking for rejection of the district court's judgment, and the only judgment here is that the rehabilitator did not act arbitrarily and capriciously. That's all the Superior Court decided.
I don't think that's all that happened here. There's only one due process clause. So the Rehabilitation Court was tasked with rehabilitation of Chartered. And the court entered a series of orders that reorganized Charter. It also approved the settlement of claims. And in that process, there's no claim here that the due process clause was at all violated.
There's no claim where? When you say here, I'm sorry, here is here in this room or here in Superior Court? When you say
there's not a claim here that the Rehabilitation Court, that the proceedings that sort of, there's no facial challenge to the Rehabilitation Court.
I thought that was precisely DCHSI's point, that the rehabilitation is about getting and keeping this entity on an even keel in order to fulfill the functions and responsibilities to people, recipients of healthcare and doctors and employees, and that function is sort of a forward-looking function. It's a but that the claims that DCHSI has are more retrospective. You know, what has happened in terms of shortchanging them, and they're saying, okay, we accept when the Superior Court says that's not the business. I'm not dotting all those I's and crossing all those T's. I'm just deciding this keep the boat sailing question, right? And if that's true, then for purposes of due process, all you're looking at in the rehabilitation is, did the rehabilitator do that function consistent with the procedural needs of that task? Not, was that a procedurally adequate way to cut off DCHSI's claims?
DCHSI hasn't cited any authority for the proposition that a different standard of review.
I'm not focusing on the standard of review. I'm focusing on the scope. I mean, there are two things I think that we're probing. One is the scope of the proceeding kind of as a definitional matter, and then the other is what's coming out of it.
Just to be fair, I am focusing on that, so
right.
You can continue along that line, but you'll come back to mine then.
Why don't you continue on the – I didn't mean to interrupt. If you have further questions on the review and what came out of that, go ahead on that. But and I have a pending question about what defines the scope and nature of what the rehabilitator was doing. Is it statutory? Is it what the judge says? But follow up on the – I didn't mean to interrupt. Follow up on the questions about the standard of review.
So – at the threshold, Exxon makes clear that Rooker-Feldman continues to bar claims, even if they were not the identical claims not raised in the state court proceeding. A disappointed litigant cannot come to federal court and bring constitutional claims, but in fact go to the injury that the state order,
I don't understand why you say that. The court is very clear that preclusion is a different question than Rooker-Feldman. And the fact that they didn't raise the claim, it might, but could have raised the claim, is a preclusion issue. But it's not a Rooker-Feldman issue. Is there any place where the Superior Court resolved the Fifth Amendment taking question?
Throughout the rehabilitation court proceeding, DCHSI alleged both procedural and substantive unfairness in the proceeding.
Can you point me to any statement in the Superior Court's decision where it said there's been no Fifth Amendment violation here, either of due process or of takings clause?
In the hearing transcripts, which are included.
I got them in front of me. Go ahead. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just looking for help.
Yes, I don't have trouble.
I see.
JA 196.
What page? JA
196. Toward the bottom of the page. It says the court has reviewed all the pleadings. It's going to deny the opposition of DCHSI. This goes to the reorganization order. He refuses to strike it to show that he's considered DCHSI's objections. And he says, however, I believe, despite the allegation of due process violations, I don't agree with them. This continues on to JA 197. I believe the fact you had a hearing on this and the fact there was an order and the court signed it, I think the rehabilitators acted appropriately.
So that goes to the procedural one. What about the taking without just compensation?
Well, let me be clear that here the takings that are being alleged are the rehabilitation court's orders. That's why the injury is stemming from the Superior Court judgments and why any review by a federal court of those orders would necessarily require the federal court to conclude that the state court was wrong.
Well, we can review a decision by the state. They can bring an action that the state court took property without just compensation. It's a big issue in the Supreme Court right at this very moment, the question of whether a state court's taking comes within the compensation clause. It's not been resolved. So they can bring that action in here until the Supreme Court tells us one way or the other. It's a different claim.
This is, excuse me if I meant to say they could not, the claim was not cognizable. The claim is barred by Rooker-Feldman. If DCHSI thought, as they've alleged,
I mean, this is hypothetical. The Superior Court of the District of Columbia takes all of your money and gives you nothing back in exchange. And they issue an order saying, we don't think that, you know, we're just going to take the money and it's not manifestly unreasonable to do that. You're saying you couldn't go into federal court and challenge that taking? Because it would undermine the judgment, the unlawful judgment of the Superior Court? Which the Superior Court did not address the question of the Fifth Amendment. It just said, we're going to take your money.
And the reason that is not the situation here is that the amount of compensation, for example, the DCHSI has alleged that Chartered only got $5 million instead of the $40 to $50 million they think they were entitled to. And in the settlement, Chartered only got $48 million instead of the north of $100 million DCHSI thinks Chartered should have received. That is the very essence of what happened in the court. And so what they're saying now in federal court is, oh, that's unfair. But
that seems to me, I mean, again, it seems to me more like a preclusion issue. You know, to the extent that DCHSI signed off on giving the rehabilitator title to the property, and then there was a settlement that included settlement of those claims, I mean, that's a serious obstacle for DCHSI. And yet, the question is the obstacle in the nature of a Rooker-Feldman problem? And, you know, I realize we're not here litigating the whole case. We're here on appeal of one issue. And the difficulty is that, you know, let's say this, does it turn on what the Superior Court judge said about these claims that the judge took to be kind of ancillary and not the project before that judge? But if the court then says, well, there's not a due process violation, you know, you don't have any claims, or it's not a due process violation, you have claims taken elsewhere. And it seems like both of those things were said. But I'm focusing on this prospective writing of this ship. It's hard to say that that judgment is being appealed here. In fact, it may be the reason why they withdrew the appeal in the D.C. Court of Appeals, right? Because, actually, we're not fighting with the rehabilitation. Our battle is both preceding that and survives that.
The allegations in DCHSI's complaint make clear, I think in a way that there are legal arguments here don't, that what they're seeking to do is appeal the Superior Court's orders. And what they're trying to do is say, we should have gotten more compensation, Chartered should have received more compensation than it did. And there's no way to get at those claims unless, for example, the settlement order is vacated or overturned. Chartered has waived and released all of these claims.
That's a different, that's a merits defense, and that's not a Rooker-Feldman defense.
I agree. The issues overlap, but the reason it's relevant to Rooker-Feldman here is because in order to get at any of the claims DCHSI is raising would require review and rejection of the settlement order, which
requires the District of Columbia to pay them more money. They'd still have whatever was done with respect to the assets, whatever was done with respect. I'm not saying they're entitled to the money. I understand you're going to have probably another 100 years of litigation on the various additional defenses you have. But all they're asking for is money. They're not asking for undoing the settlement order. They're not asking to get the assets back. They're not asking any of those things. They want more money than they got. And the District of Columbia can or cannot pay that, depending on the order of a court of appeals. But it doesn't overturn the judgment. I'm still stuck on the relationship between the Superior Court and the realtor, which you describe as sort of symbiotic, but which, when I look at the D.C. Code, doesn't sound that way. The only role of the Superior Court is to determine whether the settlement was fair and equitable. That's its role. And that is exactly what the Superior Court judge says in approving the settlement. That I, you know, I just, I'm trying to find the exact spot not here. He says, the court, the role of the court is to determine under the circumstances of each case whether the settlement is fair. The court's role in the rehabilitation process is to supervise the rehabilitator, review the actions for abusive indiscretion, and not to substitute the court's judgment. That's, I mean, that's what we do every day when we review the decisions of the federal agencies. We, people appeal those decisions and we review them for whether they are arbitrary and capricious. And that's all. That doesn't make us or our judgment a judgment that we agree or disagree with the agency. And that's exactly what the Superior Court judge said here, that he's not necessarily agreeing. He's just settling the case. He's just approving the settlement.
That would be true in any garden variety civil litigation. I think the settlement order here is actually...
That's not true. It wouldn't be true in a garden variety civil litigation. The test would be preponderance of the evidence. The plaintiff would win if they succeeded on a more likely than not standard. Here, they can't win on a more likely than not standard. They can only win if the judgment against them, the decision below of the agency against them, was manifestly unfair or an abuse of discretion. That's not garden variety.
Let me try it again. The settlement order here and the way that the Superior Court judge approved the settlement looks exactly like it would if, in an ordinary piece of civil litigation, a judge was looking to the party settlement, he applied the same factors that he would have applied under district law.
Okay, let me ask a question on that. You said the parties. And one big question mark here is, was DCHSI a party? For purposes of Rooker-Feldman, and I know that the judge said various things in that regard, clearly it was not formally a party. So I guess my specific question is, under what circumstances must we hold that an unnamed participant in a state court proceeding becomes a party for Rooker-Feldman purposes?
As the Supreme Court has suggested, a party becomes a party for Rooker-Feldman purposes when it has been treated as a party and when it has an ability to appeal. That is exactly what happened here. And that relates, I should note, just to DCHSI as if DCHSI was itself. And the DCHSI has focused on that here because Chartered, whom DCHSI in this court attempts to stand in the shoes of, was obviously a party to the rehabilitation proceeding. And so DCHSI has...
a party for purposes of asserting one's rights when Chartered is controlled wholly by someone else. It's hard to say that DCHSI, who's being told by the judge, get out of here, you're a gadfly, you're getting in my way, I want to resolve this, go to another court, we're not dealing with that, to say that, oh, but Chartered's there representing its interests, that is not exactly easy one to swallow.
No matter whether one thinks about DCHSI as DCHSI, and the question, that's what the parties have focused on in the briefing, is whether DCHSI participated,
yes,
whether they had a right to appeal. The answer to both of those questions is yes.
I'm not so sure on right to appeal, because just the fact that the judge said go appeal and just the fact that they filed an appeal doesn't mean the Court of Appeals would not have said, hello, you're not a party, you know, no jurisdiction. So we actually don't know the answer to that from the perspective of the D.C. courts.
Whether someone is a party for Rooker-Feldman purposes is a federal question.
Right.
It's true that the D.C. Court of Appeals might have told DCHSI, you didn't comply with local rules of civil procedure. You
have any number of grounds. But my question to you is, what is the standard for when an entity is a party for purposes of Rooker-Feldman, which is, as I gather, narrower than it is for purposes even of preclusion?
It is whether they were treated as a party in, for here, the rehabilitation court. The litigation record here is crystal clear. The DCHSI did everything except.
Don't they have to be able to appeal to the highest court of the state?
That's exactly what they did. They appealed to the D.C. Court of Appeals, right. And if they had lost there, they could have appealed to the United States Supreme Court.
If they were allowed to appeal. And didn't the rehabilitator say, one of your clients today, say that they did not have standing to appeal?
So, the rehabilitator in the D.C. Court of Appeals made two arguments. One, he said DCHSI failed to formally intervene. That's simply true. It's conceded. The rehabilitator also said in the D.C. Court of Appeals that it didn't really understand how DCHSI had standing. But standing, regardless of the merit of whether they had standing or not, is not whether you have party status. And I think those two issues should be considered separately.
Well, I understand separately. Read to you from the appellate brief of the counsel for the rehabilitator. Quote, DCHSI lacks standing to appeal because it is not a party aggrieved under D.C. Code 11721B. Now, if that were correct, they could not appeal, and the Court of Appeals could not decide because it only has jurisdiction over parties aggrieved. Isn't that right?
I don't think I agree, and then let me explain why. At that point, DCHSI is in the D.C. Court of Appeals arguing about its standing. They are sort of well within what Rooker-Feldman requires, which is that they were treated as a party below and they had a right to appeal. And if they do, so the D.C. Court of Appeals could say, well, no, you were a party.
Just to keep the hypothetical clean, what if the D.C. Court of Appeals said you do not have standing to appeal because you are not a party aggrieved under D.C. Code 11-721B, and therefore we will not hear your appeal? Under those circumstances, you would agree that Rooker-Feldman doesn't apply, correct?
No. For the reason specifically that it's black-letter law that a litigant's position, whether it has merit or is mistaken, cannot manufacture this court's federal subject matter jurisdiction.
I'm asking you if the D.C. Court of Appeals decided that they didn't have standing, they could not appeal the decision of the Superior Court, then? Not if some party told them that, if they decided that. Since the purpose of Rooker-Feldman is to force appeals to go through the state court system, if the state court says you're not a party, you don't have standing to appeal, and the Supreme Court has said Rooker-Feldman doesn't apply where you're not a party, and the reason it doesn't apply is because you can't go through the state court system. This seems like a very easy thing. I mean, maybe you think it hurts your case, but I need an honest answer to the question.
The D.C. Court of Appeals never had a chance to issue that ruling.
So now we have to decide, right? So basically we would have to decide, in order to resolve this, we would have to decide whether they had standing for purposes of the D.C. Court of Appeals.
What I'm not sure about in your question is the different, parties can lack standing at any time. Right? Many cases go on for years, and then the court says, wait a minute, you have no standing. That doesn't make them not a party.
Question is whether it makes it not a party for Rooker-Feldman purposes. If we agree, and I think we just have, that the purpose of Rooker-Feldman is to prevent a federal court, other than the Supreme Court, from reviewing a decision of a state court, because there is a federal statute which says those kinds of appeals are supposed to go through the Supreme Court. Now, if they can't go through the Supreme Court because you weren't a party, Rooker-Feldman says expressly, Exxon says expressly, that you can, and Lance, that you cannot use Rooker-Feldman there because the person wasn't able to appeal through the state court system. Is anything I've said wrong so far?
That's all right.
All right. So then, really, the job, our job, is to decide whether the rehabilitator was correct or incorrect when he told the Court of Appeals that DCHSI cannot appeal because they lack standing. I don't know what the right answer is necessarily, and I appreciate that we're not bound by what the rehabilitator has said. On the other hand, it's as persuasive as a brief, and we have to decide whether it's correct or not.
The gravamen of the Rooker-Feldman requirement that there is a party, that they actually participated, is amply fulfilled in the circumstances here. DCHSI participated like a full litigant at all times throughout the rehabilitation proceeding. In fact, at the entry of the settlement order, counsel for DCHSI said as much. It expressed surprise that they might have had to file a piece of paper to formally intervene when they had simply been treated as a party throughout, including filing discovery requests, voluminous briefs, and et cetera. They were treated as a party in the rehabilitation court.
Well, let me give you another hypothetical. Citizens for Protection of Healthcare in the District of Columbia files an amicus brief in the Superior Court in this very case, hypothetical. And the judge says, you know, you guys are really good lawyers. I want you to participate in every possible way. You don't have standing. You're not. You have no assets in this case. But you're good lawyers, and I'd like you to participate in every way as if you were a party. Does that decision against them, would they be bound? They may not have that standing in federal court either, but the fact is, just because you're treated as a party doesn't make you a party unless you have a right to appeal.
It was the judgment of the rehabilitation court that DCHSI did have a right to appeal. In fact, on multiple occasions.
I think you're a little bit overreading that. If a court is on a task and a party is coming in and saying, or an entity is coming in and saying, you know, look at this evidence, consider our claim, and the judge is saying, no, I'm not going to do that. I have an urgent task in front of me. And the party's counsel saying, that's wrong, that's wrong, look at the Constitution. And the judge says, you go appeal that. Like, you know, someone else can tell me I'm wrong, but I think I'm right. The fact that he says, you go appeal that, doesn't mean that he's thought about, you know, gotten briefing on and considered the jurisdictional question of whether that entity actually has appeal rights.
And to support Judge Pillard's point, he didn't say you have a right to appeal. He said you have a right to note an appeal, which, of course, anybody can note an appeal. That doesn't mean you get a right to appeal. And then another party says, frankly, you don't have standing. That's a quotation.
Right. DCHSI pursued its appeal all the way until a week before oral argument. I think the litigation record here demonstrates the level of participation and the seriousness with which the Superior Court, the Rehabilitation Court, treated all of DCHSI's filings, as they were recognized in that proceeding as a party in interest. It seems like it would be quite an odd result if the formality of whether or not they actually filed a motion to intervene and it was granted, which the rehabilitation court said, if you had filed one, I probably would have granted it. I don't know how the federal question of a party under Rooker-Feldman can turn on that sort of procedural or formalistic distinction under district law. Looking at what actually transpired in the rehabilitation court and DCHSI's appeal to the D.C. Court of Appeals, which was the entirely proper way to get at whether they had any objections, procedural unfairness or substantive unfairness, of those orders, that is exactly what 1257 requires a party to do. think that, I mean, I think that adequately, and, amply supports that they were a party for Rooker-Feldman purposes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The judgment should be affirmed.
Figured that would be the last line. You're out of time, but we'll give you some more time, as we usually do here, 2 more minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just respond to one particular point made by opposing counsel. That's the statement at JA-196 and 197 of the appendix by the Superior Court judge. However, I believe that there has, despite the allegation of due process violations, are in process. I don't agree with that contention. I believe the fact that he had a hearing on this and the fact there was an order, which the court signed, that gave the rehabilitator the right under the statute to marshal the assets and to seek rehabilitation, as you have argued, I think they've acted appropriately. Does that resolve your Fifth Amendment due process argument?
It does not. The reason is, what the judge is, what Judge Wright is addressing there is a due process claim that is about the sufficiency of the process in the rehabilitation. So DCHSI is saying essentially, look, you don't get time to file briefs, Your Honor. You didn't, consider what we've said under state law sufficiently. That's actually not the due process claim, the procedural due process claim that we assert here, right? So we're also a substantive due process.
Yeah, I understand that. What's the difference between what you claim and what the court said there?
And what we claim is that it's the state that didn't give sufficient process.
Sorry, Kayla,
the state that didn't give sufficient process. Example from the complaint, you could, if you want to look at the paragraphs that sort of describe it, it's 48 and 36. What the rehabilitation court was involved as the DCH, sorry, as Trump is right. Because they're being intentionally underpaid, the insurance regulator has a decision that the account based on what Chartered says, they're being underpaid counts as part of their assets for purposes of whether they go into rehabilitation or not. DCHSI will try to input. They don't go to a neutral third party to decide whether that should happen. They just say, look, you have so you've got to rehabilitation. And the to do with that. He doesn't, that's not presented to him. Nobody ever asks him, is that the right decision? Was that, should the insurance regulator have asked you some questions? Should they have gone to
But he does approve a settlement on the merits of all those claims as part of the rehabilitation, right? It's one of the component pieces of the rehabilitation that, and it's actually one of the things that you complain about, is that there's an evaluation only of a slice of the underpayments, and then they compromise that as if it stands for all of the underpayments, but that's settled and released.
Yes. To claim process and taking claims, to get here, we're protecting these people, we're not the doctors, you can come with these claims because that's a, that. Social goal, but paid and then put into rehabilitation caused us to have this and then lose that property.
This is sort of a question I think Judge Pillard was asking before, the difference between earlier claims and pre-claims, and is that what you're talking about? earlier than the earlier than what happened under the rehabilitator?
Sorry, say it again.
Earlier. No, you can't hear either.
Earlier.
I'm having a little trouble with the sound system. Earlier than what happened under the rehabilitator. These process claims that you're raising, is that what you're saying?
Section 1983 claims. One of the damages by the difference between the day we had a functioning company and the value of the company that day, the day before the course of conduct began, right? And then at the end of the at the end of the course of conduct. So, the insurance regulator had paid more attention to us, or, you know, gone to a third party and given us more process, then we would have got the better settlement. We're saying that piece of the conduct that caused us to lose it. Maybe if they had a third party, maybe the district would have sort of woken up and said, oh, yeah, we do have, you know, $80 million, you go. And we'll continue to
Mr. Mitz, you have two things that give me pause. One is, you said you're not challenging that settlement. Now, that may not be Rooker-Feldman relevant, but that seems like that's an independent ground for us to just affirm. I mean, isn't that settlement a settlement of the very claims that you're, the very amounts of money that you're asserting in your Section 1983 claim?
It's not. It's both. Doesn't match the amount of money that we're asking for.
Yeah, they didn't give the amount of money, but they required release of all those claims, I thought.
Early claims, middle claims, late claims.
And I only evaluated the middle claims as part of your, temporarily, as part of your assertion, but they got a release on the whole nine yards.
Right. That's right. So, two things. First, DCHSI. The contract appeals board claims are not DCHSI.
They're charters.
They're charters. So what DCHSI had was a business. So DCHSI was a business that the state does state statutory scheme. That's backed under that state statutory scheme. And charters have to have a loan. So that should have gotten more in the settlement of those claims. It isn't a rule. The judge can't say, hey, district, you have to pay charter. He just says, hey, rehabilitator, I agree or disagree with what you've suggested. But even if all the contract appeals board claims, they get, you know, every penny, every dollar. They still lost. DCHSI has still lost its business because it's already sold.
This was the other thing that you said that gave me pause in Rooker-Feldman terms. You said, we never should have been in rehabilitation in the first place. Is that not another way of saying we are appealing the very fact of the rehabilitation?
No, it's not. And the point is not that when the insurance company that's running out of money and the judge said, well, should I approve this, you know, should I sign it in rehabilitation that the judge did something wrong? We do not say that the judge did something wrong. What we say is the district intentionally underpaid us by tens of millions of dollars for all of this time. And that, again, is not in dispute. The fact that the district does that is wrong. And the fact that the rehabilitation can, the district ultimately doesn't have to make up for that and instead takes all of that property. We go from having a business to having nothing. Section 1983 provides a place in federal courts where you can come in and say, that's the right story is the right story. But for Rooker-Feldman purposes, frankly, for conclusion purposes, when we allege this lets us, I think, get into federal court to ask for a remedy. request that the court reverse.
Okay.
Thank you.
Complicated case. We'll take it under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you.